Good evening, lovelies. I use that word very consciously. Every retreat I teach, as the days go on, you all get more and more lovely to me. And I think also as we engage in this practice, especially in intensive retreat like this, as the days go on, we do get more and more lovely. That's part of what happens with the practice. So I'll offer some thoughts on the Dhamma this evening, and then we'll sit, and then maybe time for some questions if it comes up about what I covered. To start with, I'd like to start where Anushka's story left off of the Bodhisattva under the Bodhi tree on the night of his enlightenment. So reaching down, touching the earth, calling on the Mother Goddess of the Earth to bear witness to his many, many lifetimes of perfecting the paramis, and in answer to Mara's question of trying to instill doubt in his mind of what right do you have to be sitting there. He said, well, this is what right I have. And Mara vanishes. And then now with Mara vanished, there are no hindrances, there are no obstacles in the way of the Bodhisattva's practice. And practices into the night. And on the first watch of the night, when the first watch of the night is over, the Bodhisattva could see clearly all his past lives, just clearly, every single one of them became apparent to him. And he kept practicing, and at the end of the second watch of the night, the Bodhisattva saw how it is that all humans, all beings, keep what propels them in this process of birth, death, and rebirth over and over and over again. Saw that very clearly. It's called the wheel of dependent origination. How that happens, what's driving it. And what he saw is that ignorance was driving it. And that's another talk. So we'll leave that there. But important to know. And then in the third watch of the night, just as the dawn star was, I think, setting on the horizon, Bodhisattva's mind opened completely to the truth of the way things are. And what he opened to and what he discovered was what I'm going to talk about tonight is the Four Noble Truths. And upon realizing that his heart and mind were completely freed for good of all that afflicts it, completely free of suffering. So the Four Noble Truths, all the teachings that the Buddha gave can be found somehow, somewhere in these Four Noble Truths or connected to these Four Noble Truths. You can hear different lineages of Buddhism, of kind of Theravada Buddhism or early Buddhism practice, Mahayana, Vajrayana, Zen Buddhism, all these different kind of schools that have found particular ways of practicing and manifesting the path. And where they all kind of convene or what they all have in common is the Four Noble Truths. What the Buddha discovered is the first truth is that life's not going to be the way you want it to be all the time. It's just not. Sometimes when you want to go for a hike, it's going to rain out. Sometimes you stub your toe and it hurts. Sometimes people say things to you and you feel bad. Sometimes you name it. There are these worldly winds that the teachings speak of, these four sets of worldly winds, like praise and blame, fame and disrepute, gain and loss, pleasure and pain. And these things are just happening beyond our control. Sometimes we'll be praised, sometimes we'll be blamed. Sometimes there'll be a sense of gain in our life, of things coming to us. Sometimes loss, things taken away or lost, or circumstances having them scatter outwards, not in our possession, etc. It's not always the way we want it to be. It's not, as much as we try, we're not going to get it to be just right. Have you noticed that yet? Right? We're not going to get it. We don't get to have it exactly the way we want it. I remember when I kind of realized, I was like, no, that's actually not going to happen. It's not going to happen. Because I'd have to be living in a different universe for it to happen. Because it's lawful. And so these things that life presents itself and unfolds in ways that isn't to our liking or to our wishes. It's difficult, it's challenging. And this is just the truth. This is just how it is. If we're born, we're going to come up against this. It's kind of what we sign up for. It's part of the package deal. There's nothing wrong when this happens. It's supposed to be this way some of the time. Not all the time. Sometimes people mistakenly think that in the Buddha's teachings that the first noble truth is that life is suffering. And that's not true. What the Buddha is saying, if you are born, you will come into contact with these conditions. You will come into contact with what we've been talking about, sight, smells, taste, touch, hearing, and then things in the mind that aren't agreeable to us, that are hard, that are painful, that are difficult. Have you noticed? And I say that it's kind of like, you know, cute, but it's also, as you'll see, actually of extreme importance, this noticing. So, the first noble truth, this is going to happen. And we can kind of hear that in a cursory way or surface way and kind of go, yeah, I know that. So we'll see. Now, this can happen, and there can either be suffering or not suffering. Sometimes when this happens, and often when it happens, we suffer because of it. And the second noble truth is why? Why do we suffer when these things happen? Why is it that it causes suffering? What is the mechanism that causes us to suffer when things go this way? And the second noble truth is a noble truth of craving. Tanha in Pali. So the first one is dukkha in Pali. The second noble truth is tanha. And translated literally, not to mean craving, but the literal translation means thirst. And so craving, of course, is the desire for, which the word would imply, but it also includes this not wanting as well, but kind of both sides of that coin. I want this, I don't want this. I want more of that, keep that away. I like this, I don't like this. All those movements of the mind, that's what actually causes us to suffer. Not the things that happen themselves, but this mind state. Buddhism teaches that our suffering is not outside of us. It's not inherent in the conditions that arise, in the way someone else is acting, or what they're saying. This is, and now by the way, a little caveat, this is not to say that we don't take serious when oppression is happening, And when people are behaving in ways that are harming us or hurting us or oppressing us, it's like, it's not meant to condone that or to say, oh, it's all, you know, it's all in your mind, you know, don't worry about it. That's not what this is pointing to. So just to say that. But the suffering, when it happens in our life, that the root of it, well, again, ultimately the root of it is ignorance, but that kind of the direct cause in the moment is when there's craving in the mind. And there's three types of craving. Craving for sense pleasures. Again, this means, you know, I want this one, but I don't want that one. Includes both. And then these two, the craving for becoming, bhava tanha, and the craving for non-becoming, vibhava tanha. And what is that? That's more like, so craving for becoming will be something like, it'll be really good when, I'll be the happy person when I go on that vacation, or I get that job, or I come into that relationship, or, okay? And then the craving for non-becoming is, I'll be the happy person when I don't have to do this job anymore, when I don't have to be in this relationship anymore, when this situation in my life that I really don't like and I'm resisting, when that ends, when I can get away from that, then it'll be good. And these two First Noble Truths have a very intimate relationship with one another. So, just clearly, by definition of the Four Noble Truths, that the cause of our suffering is when there's craving, yeah? But there's another teaching that is equally important. And that is, what is the cause of craving? So the cause of suffering is craving, but what's the cause of craving? Besides a mistaken sense of a separate self, the proximate cause for craving to arise is ignorance of dukkha. When we don't see clearly the truth of dukkha, that is the ripe, that's the condition that's very ripe for craving to arise. Remember I said, have you noticed? And how important that is? When we ignore, when there's ignorance of dukkha, it sets the stage, it's the fertile ground for craving to arise from. So let's just maybe look at a couple of examples of what that might look like. So if ignoring dukkha, we don't have an understanding of that life is like this, meaning sometimes it's disagreeable. Sometimes it's not going to be the way we want it. Like, and that, again, that's not wrong. That's just how it is. So when we don't see that, or to the degree that we don't see that clearly, when life presents itself in ways that are disagreeable to us, are difficult, challenging, etc., we rail against. We're not in accord with it. Remember, Anushka was talking about the gravity, and when we can be in accord with that and in congruent with it, it's like, oh, we roll with it, right? Well, it's the same here. But in this case, we're not in accord with it. We're not congruent with dukkha. We're ignorant of it. And so we don't roll with it. We rail against it. This shouldn't be happening. Why does it always rain when I want to go hiking? Always. We hear the always word, we know we're in trouble. Why does it always rain when I go hiking? I want it to be different. How's that? How's that state? Is that a happy-making state or a suffering state? Right, it's a suffering state. I'll tell you a little story. One time, it was my wife's birthday, and I planned this like surprise trip. It's one of those like just pack your bags, you know. I had it all planned out, and we were gonna go to Boston and take this special fast ferry that gets you to Cape Cod like in 30 minutes, and have this really nice place to stay, and blah blah blah. So we're going, and we're driving, and going, and we get up to the Mass Pike, and that's the highway in Massachusetts. And I come around the corner, and here's our entrance to the pike, and it's blocked. Mass Pike closed. And I was like, my mind just went, no. It went no, and it really threw a hissy. What do you mean the pike is closed? You just can't close the goddamn highway. What are they thinking? And just really like railing against that, you know, conditions were not how I wanted them to be. And it was so bad that at one point my wife said, Chaz, this is my birthday, and birthdays are supposed to be fun, and this is not fun. It's like, okay. But even after that, like it wouldn't let go for a little while. It was hard to let go of the no. And finally, it's like, okay, we'll drive to Cape Cod. It's going to be fine. The rest of the weekend's going to be fine. But it's just such an example of the suffering that can come when there's craving in the mind. No, I don't want this. Or I do want this, and in this case, I don't want this. It's painful. It's very painful for us and the people around us. So that truth wasn't available to me in the moment. Oh, this is what happens sometimes. You want to go someplace, and it's not possible. Had that been more present for me, had that truth been, had that wisdom, so avijja, wisdom, not ignorant, vijja is, or did I get that backwards? Anyway, the opposite of ignorance, if that was present, it would have been like, it still would have been a drag. It's like, oh, you know, it's like, oh, I wanted to surprise her, but there wouldn't have been the suffering. There wouldn't have been the angst and the turmoil in the heart and mind. So just to say, it doesn't mean that all of a sudden we're kind of like, oh, the pike is closed. No, it's still difficult. It's still difficult. And there's a wonderful teaching from the Buddha's life about this. He had two, we call chief disciples, which were his closest monks to him, like really his friends, and these two monks that helped him with the Sangha and to teach and hold, really, the whole thing. And they both died before him, and they both died within the same year. And he said to Ananda one time, Ananda was his cousin and also his attendant for many years, until he died. And he said, Ananda, it is like the sun and the moon have gone out of the sky. So this sense of loss, like these two people died, and it's like the sun and the moon have gone out of the sky. Okay, so it's not like, ha, ha, ha. But then the next sentence he said, and isn't it amazing that the Tathagata does not suffer over this? So the Tathagata is how he referred to himself. It means like, one thus gone, like gone over to the other shore of freedom. So there can be this knowing. It's not like we turn into automatons. There's this knowing of difficulty, or in this case, of loss. But his wisdom was perfect, his seeing was perfect, and the truth of the way things are was so, it was him, that there was no suffering, because of course this happens. How could it not happen? He would tell his followers very, very often if they were really suffering a whole lot over someone that had died, he would say, you know, how many times have I told you that it is not possible for this not to happen? So that truth of loss, you know, one of the challenging things in this life, very challenging and difficult, was close to him. It was always available to him, and therefore he didn't suffer. But he did feel the loss, and to illustrate that challenges are challenging, difficulties are difficult. That doesn't stop. Don't think that you're going to practice and then somehow live in Shangri-La where, you know, nothing bad ever happens or nothing challenging ever happens. That's, sorry to say, but that's not how it goes. Often when we start to practice, we want to think that, but hopefully soon we see that that's not the end game. The end game is being in accord with the truthfulness of that and not having the heart and mind really disturbed and suffer over it. So, dukkha, the cause of it, when we suffer, is craving, and craving arises supported by ignorance of dukkha, of not seeing it clearly. So these two are very, very intertwined and inform one another. Really helpful to both, you know, intellectually, but more experientially as we practice, really see how these two are entwined together. So that's the first and second noble truth. So you could say suffering and its cause, or suffering and what causes it. And then the next two noble truths are happiness and what causes it, 3 and 4. Third noble truth is the end of suffering. In Pali, Nibbana, translated as enlightenment usually. Literal translation or literal meaning of the word is to cool down or to cool off. The mind that is often in the teachings, in the suttas, there's some very actually poetic and flowery language in the sutta. Well, this isn't flowery, it's kind of intense, but descriptive about how the mind is on fire with craving, with wanting and not wanting. It's not peaceful, it's agitated. The way fire agitates, if you've ever seen fire, it's like flickering and agitating. The mind, the unenlightened mind, the mind afflicted with craving is on fire. And then when craving is abandoned, the mind cools. It's like, the absence of craving. When the third noble truth is spoken of, it refers to the complete end of craving. When the mind is fully liberated, the it's called the roots are actually pulled up. Like it can't sprout again. It's gone forever. The mind is free of that. Never craving is never to arise again in the mind. So the third noble truth of Nibbana is pointing to that kind of final uprooting of all the defilements. But we can also kind of experience it in kind of miniature or momentary forms. And you can see that many times a day, actually, on retreat, if you're kind of looking in that way. And maybe you can relate to this one. You're sitting there, body's painful, and you kind of catch yourself kind of like bracing against it, kind of like, oh, how much time is left? Like, you know, there's craving in the mind. Yeah, I don't like this. I don't want this. And you notice that. And then maybe there's a, you know, can I be with this? Can I? And and the mind kind of goes, and maybe a yes arises in the mind. It's like, yes, I'll allow this to be here. I'll allow myself to connect with this experience of pain in the body. And in that moment, no problem. There's no problem being with that pain. That the problematic nature of life that was there a moment ago vanishes. And that we can see as like a little Nibbana moment. The craving that was there vanishes, and what's left is a deep okayness. No problem. What we're after in this path is not a something. It's not something we're going to get. Did I do the Bodhidharma quote yet with Emperor Wu? Did I say, okay. So there's a teaching from the Zen tradition, the Conversations of Bodhidharma, who was the first Zen patriarch. He brought Zen from China to Japan. Well, it wasn't Zen in China, it was Chan, but he brought it to Japan, it became Zen. And there's this kind of infamous set of teachings about this conversation he had with Emperor Wu. And Bodhidharma was reputed to be an enlightened being, and Emperor Wu wanted to know, like, wow, what'd you get out of that? Like, tell me about it, you know? And Bodhidharma said, I did not gain a single thing through attaining supreme enlightenment. And Emperor Wu got up and walked away. Because he was in the mindset of which most of us enter this path with, by the way, of getting something. And it's like, this guy's supposed to be enlightened. He didn't get anything. He's not enlightened. I'm out of here. Got to get something. But we don't. It's actually what's left over when craving ends. Imperfect, but maybe a little bit of the flavor analogy. You're at home. There's no music on. There's no TV. So it's quiet. And you're by yourself, you're not talking with anyone, and all of a sudden, the refrigerator shuts off and gets your attention. Yeah? That's like, oh, I didn't even notice. I didn't even notice kind of how agitating that was until it ended. And it's like, oh, that's nice. A little bit in the genre of that. It's what's left over that's nice, not what we get. It's the absence of craving. You could call it deep contentment. You could call it peace. You can call it freedom from suffering. We don't get it. Getting something is antithetical to the path. So there can be moments that we can experience when craving is abandoned. And that's what we're to do with craving. Each of the noble truths has something. The Buddha says, okay, this is the truth, and here's what you're supposed to do with it. So the first truth is to be experienced, to be known. We have to experience it so that we're not ignorant of it. So we kind of know it, but we don't really want to look at it. We don't want to see, like, oh yeah, life is just hard sometimes. We rail against that. So it's, the first truth is to be experienced, clearly experienced. The second craving is to be abandoned. Let it go. Abandon that in the mind. The third, Nibbana, is to be realized. We want to realize the end of suffering for ourselves. Not just hear in a Dharma talk or read about it. We want to realize that experience for ourselves. And then the fourth noble truth, so happiness is the third, you could call it. And then how do we do this? How do we come to the end of suffering? How do we come to abandon craving? And that's the Noble Eightfold Path. And what we're to do with that is to develop it, cultivate it, practice it. All those words kind of speak to, yeah, engage. And that's a whole nother talk, but it's it includes things like the five trainings about how we conduct ourselves in this world, our speech, our actions, what we do for a livelihood. These are all part of the Eightfold Path. Meditation, mindfulness is part of it. Concentration, effort, making the right effort, which I want to speak to in a moment. And then wisdom. There are two wisdom path factors: wise view and wise intention. So that's the fourth one. So it's a real kind of like a crib notes, Four Noble Truths, suffering and its cause, happiness and its cause. Easy way to remember them. So this thing called wise effort, sometimes it's talked about in terms of like, what's the correct effort to make on this path or when we're meditating? And the Buddha talked about in a sutta, he spoke to this, and it's called crossing the flood. And so in kind of Buddhist teachings, the near shore, like there's a flood, there's a big water and it's turbulent. The near shore of that flood is where we are kind of in a state of ignorance. And the far shore is a state of non-ignorance, of enlightenment. And we want to cross over to that. That's kind of the analogy. And so this being one time, actually a deva, came down from the deva realms, throw in a little cosmology, and asked the Buddha, how did you cross the flood? And the Buddha said, by not pushing forward and by not standing still, I crossed the flood. And he would often say, not how we did something, but how not to do something. And the deva said, but sir, how is it that, you know, you didn't push forward and how is it that you didn't stand still? And the Buddha said, when I pushed forward, I was whirled about. And when I stood still, I sank. And so by not pushing forward and by not standing still, I crossed the flood. And what these stand for is, you know, maybe you can get a sense, is that when we're trying too hard, or some of you in your groups, they were talking about coming in with expectations, or I want to get to a certain state, or I want to have something happen. This whole genre is pushing forward. We're trying too hard. We want to get something. When we want to get something, we're pushing forward. And we're whirled about, meaning we start to struggle and we get confused and doubt arises. We're whirled about. And then standing still is just not doing anything, not practicing, not cultivating mindfulness, just kind of sleepwalking through life the way we had been. And we sink. What do? We sink into greed, hatred, and delusion. So it's somewhere in the middle of that. And for many of us in this culture, the standing still is not so much the problem. It's the pushing forward. We're really indoctrinated into, I want to work hard to get something. And in other realms of life, that can be quite advantageous to have that quality. Yeah? But in this realm, not so much. We want to apply ourselves fully, for sure, but it's not so that we can get something. When we're in that space, we're actually kind of working against ourselves. Another way to speak about this pushing forward or this trying too hard or what we would call sometimes in practice striving. You've been on retreat now for 2 days, so I know you have the experience of this, is that practice is all over the place. I'm sleepy, I'm not sleepy, I'm restless, I'm not restless, I'm fairly present, I'm all over the place. I really like what the teachers are saying, I hate the teachers, this practice is great, I don't think this practice is for me, right? It's variable. Some of it is we like, some of it we don't like. Ah, dukkha. Things are not going to be the way we like them all the time. If we're ignorant of dukkha, then as we go through retreat and these experiences that we don't like come up in practice, we rail against them. What am I doing wrong? Let me try harder. No, it's just how it is. Crazy mind is like this. Sleepiness is like this. Judging the teachers is like this. And it changes. These things that Anushka talked about, they move through. So ignorance of dukkha is very supportive of trying too hard on retreat. Can we settle back and just know sometimes it's going to be like this, sometimes it's going to be like this. And in the when we don't rail against that and we settle back, now we're in the space that's very conducive of being present, of clear seeing, of equanimity. I just wanted to mention that because it came up in the groups a bit today. And you don't have to worry about trying too hard. We all try too hard until we don't. You're going to try too hard until you don't. That's okay. You'll learn. But this is just a little, shine a light on that. And then we can kind of be on the lookout for that just a little bit. Maybe we get on that train and we only have to go 5 stops instead of 7 stops before we get off. So we practice and our understanding of the Four Noble Truths slowly deepens. And enlightenment in the Buddha's teachings is synonymous with full understanding of the full and perfect understanding of the Four Noble Truths. That's synonymous with enlightenment itself. So, why is that important? When you are practicing and you notice craving, you think, ugh, I blew it again. Fantasizing about winning the lottery again. I'm a terrible yogi. No. Seeing of that, and remember labeling it, oh, okay, craving. And then just in the labeling, remember, oh, now we're a little bit detached from it, just from saying it. Just, oh, you're practicing enlightenment itself. You're practicing the Four Noble Truths. So right in that moment, you're beginning to abandon craving. So, you know, I hope you can remember this when it's like, and it will come up, it's like, what's the use of this? Why am I doing this? You're actually practicing enlightenment itself. Okay, enough words for this evening. I hope that these words on the Four Noble Truths are supportive for your path. And we'll sit now and let them settle and just be in silence with whatever is reverberating for you or resonating with these teachings. And I think we're just going to sit, not going to do questions. And so if you were looking forward to that, and it's like, oh, dukkha, okay. Things aren't always go the way I want them to. It's everywhere. It's a truth. Yeah. It's not why I'm doing it, but it's just an example of... May your practice lead you to your deepest happiness and freedom. We have a walking period now, and then back together for the last sit and some metta practice. It's recommend maybe to go outside and commune with the quietness and the stillness of the night, to maybe do some walking outside.